Friends, before we begin this episode, I want to extend you a personal invitation to join me here on the campus of Midwestern Seminary and Spurgeon College for our upcoming Spring Preview Day. On April the 11th, you'll be able to meet our faculty, enjoy some incredible Kansas City barbecue, tour the Spurgeon Library, take in all that is Midwestern Seminary and Spurgeon College, and also be entered to win incredible gifts like a new MacBook Air, which we trust will position you well as you prepare to be a student. For more information, please go to mbts.edu. That is mbts.edu. Well, ladies and gentlemen, if I can have your attention, we're going to proceed with our conversation. So let me invite you to, if you'd like, to reposition your chairs just to get the most out of the next few minutes together. This will not be protracted. He's getting back to the UK, and we'll get back to classes and other responsibilities. But a part of the lectureships, we customarily enjoy at least a brief lunch and a conversation one of the 2 days. In the room today, Peter, are just a number of our faculty members, and it looks like a lot of our PhD students here as well. And so just wanted them to have a little bit more exposure to you and to the work of Tyndale House in particular. So let's start with you. Say a few words about your background, how you came to faith in Christ, your interest in biblical studies, and then how you found your way to Tyndale House.
Great. Well, thank you very much for having me here and a delicious lunch. So I'm 54, grew up in a Christian family, and just had parents of incredible integrity, and that gave me great confidence. Trusting them, came to faith early teens, struggled a little bit, teenage years, and then particularly university, where I went through a period of doubt. Been happy to, being brought through that by God, and been married 28 years to Catherine, got a couple of adult. That's not a Freudian slip. Adult children who are believers, which is wonderful.
And you went to university intending to study what?
Greek, Latin, Hebrew, and Aramaic.
You're committed to the languages pre any sense of ministry or really service.
I wanted to be a Bible translator, so obviously you need to, learn Aramaic.
So how did that harmonize with your season of doubt?
It sort of brought it on, because it was in my third year meeting people who knew the Bible better than anyone I'd ever met and didn't believe it, and could ask tough questions about things and set you SR driver to read and so on. And they were sort of raising things that I just wasn't in any way equipped to deal with. Neither of my parents had got degrees. And there I was, as far as I knew, first person in my family, getting to Cambridge. They were asking very tough questions about if this thing's by Moses, why is he saying the other side of Jordan when it's this side, and all this sort of thing. And they're not really defeater questions when you look at them now, but they are. They felt really powerful at the time. And I don't think I'd ever really contemplated the thought that things might not be true. And when that thought comes to you for the first time, it's a very scary thought. But God put people around me. There was a guy called D.A. Carson and another guy called Mark Dever who were around. They were somewhat helpful. But, the Holy Spirit did the work. So, yeah.
And then give us a sense as to how you got to Tyndale House.
So I became aware it was there through the Eugene and Janet Merrill, if any of you know them, and their daughter Sonia, who were spending time over in Cambridge. Their daughter was in my college, and when she heard I was talking about Bible, she said, you've got to come around and meet my parents at Tyndale House. It's funny, through some Americans, I got to see this thing in Cambridge I had no idea existed. And then I went from postgraduate onwards. I was taking a desk at Tyndale House and had my second postdoctoral job there, and now my fourth job. So
some in the room are very familiar with Tyndale House. Many in the room are not. So give us a sense as to what it is, what it isn't, where it's situated, and what it does.
So starting with what it isn't, it's not at all connected with the publishers, Tyndale House publishers, that began in 1962. So we go back to 1944 or 45, depending when you want to count. And we're a Bible research institute. So think of normally having 60 spaces in a research library that's one of the best research libraries on the Bible in the world, next to an 800-year-old university, but we are an evangelical foundation aiming to promote the evangelical Christian religion. And so we'll do that by every method we can, land, sea, and air. So once you've got you know, we've got property there, we've got places where we can accommodate people, you have a community, but we also have projects. So people like you can come and do a sabbatical at Tindo House and have a desk. And if you're in biblical studies, all the books should be there. And the gong will go at 11 o'clock and you can have tea and coffee and meet with other scholars and have worship together and so on and really get built up. But it could be you're doing a postgraduate degree and you could even be doing a PhD at Midwestern and spend some time over with us. And we'd love that, you know, if you want to spend a month or two or three. And people can do a PhD, let's say at our local university, Cambridge University, where for 3 years they might be in our community. That's what's being, they're being, where they're being socialized and trained and encouraged. But their piece of paper says, I got a PhD from Cambridge University. So that's a great opportunity. Then we bring in groups of students from poorer countries or faculty. So just this morning I saw we're going to have a group of 6 Romanians come through. We've had quite a few of them come working on a new Romanian Bible translation. They'll do that in our space. But we've also been doing that with, you know, Cubans, Brazilians, Egyptians, and so on. And then we have research projects. So we have a Greek New Testament we've edited, and we are working on a new edition of that. And we are also working on sort of a names database of the ancient world and what we can say about the meaning of Bible names. We got 4 postdocs working on that. So it's really... That works in a different way from our regular work because it's like independently funded. But it, you know, the size that sort of stuff could grow to is mainly constrained by having enough good people to hire. But it's money. There's always a triangle, money space people. But I'd say people are often the thing that most short of.
So 2 of our faculty members, and forgive me if I'm overlooking a third, but completed their PhDs at Cambridge while being nested there. At Tindal House, Radu Gurgitsa, and now here recently, Peter Gurry, correct?
Yeah, that's right, yeah. So I remember Radu when he was doing his PhD and memorizing Hebrews and Greek and that sort of thing. And, you know.
He spends a lot of time memorizing.
Yeah. He was starting off, I think he even got me over to Romania one time. Peter Gurry, likewise, you know, his family living on our site. And that was wonderful. And there may be others, but certainly those two. Peter's PhD is Cambridge University. His supervisor was someone who was formerly one of our staff. So there's a sort of connection there. And a lot of the shaping of the project, you know, we would feel has happened with us. And, you know, one of the things that happens is just that people keep their faith and grow in the faith. And that's a key thing for us because humans aren't just persuaded by arguments. You know how humans are more persuaded by fonts with serif than they are ones without. So it's this interesting thing and just how showing a community as with a seminary or a research center in Cambridge, that's really important for helping people take the ideas forward.
So there was a lot going on in Britain in 1942, 43, 44,
yep.
45,
yep.
And for that matter, 39 and 4.
Yeah.
What was the perceived need then that prompted the formation of Tindal House?
Well, I mean, it was really the sense that evangelicals had been locked out of the elite universities and that there was a need to train people, but not by recreating a university, but by creating institutions that could sit alongside the university. And so that's where people were planning already from about 1938 onwards to try and set up something to counter this. And in 1944, before D-Day, when property prices were nice and depressed, they bought this site in Cambridge we've been able to benefit from.
And what is Tindal House's confessional statement?
So we have what historically was the University and Colleges Christian Fellowship confessional statement, which was the same as the InterVarsity Fellowship's original one. And then we've added to that an ethos statement, because obviously it doesn't say anything about, say, same-sex relationships or anything like that. So that's our confessional statement. But the way it would work is, anyone can come into the library who we say can come into the library. So we've had some atheists come in, and we have had a rabbi recently. We have some Israeli scholars come. And so we're an evangelical place, and that's absolutely clear, but we're one with an open door to the university. And really, what we have is, let's say layers and an onion, but we have, you know, much more precise things we would require of people who are further in. So with our research staff, we have a very specific set of things that we need to query people on, but they're not the sort of things you'd necessarily put on a statement of faith, if that makes sense. But we're wanting to make sure that people are people who really trust that scripture is entirely true in a practical way.
And you guys are in the process of producing a second edition of the Greek New Testament that came out, what, 6 or 7 years ago?
Yep. So Dirk Jonkers just finished a draft of a big commentary on the text of the New Testament that, if you think of Bruce Metzger's commentary, it's a bit like that, but also different because it will be majoring on what we know individual manuscripts do at particular points, what's called scribal habits. So that's great. And then it will lead towards a second edition. And Greek New Testaments, thankfully, don't differ that much. We're very proud of the things that are slightly different because we feel they're better. But I think a key aspect is also we're trying to, with Crossway, work so it's very, very readable. And if you don't already get free Greek New Testaments from Crossway, you should, find a way of approaching them, even through us, to try and get that, because they are, distributing them, trying to get them into people's hands. So that might be something for your students.
So you've been leading Tyndale House since 2007. Mm-hmm. Give us a sense, just the broad contours of your stewardship there, past, present, and Lord willing, future.
Well, arriving completely naive. Of course, if I'd known anything about leading an institution, I probably wouldn't have taken it on. If I knew anything about finances, I certainly wouldn't have taken it on. What I say is, by God's grace, God put around me people who could help. I nearly burnt out after 8 years because I when you feel built to do research and what you're doing is spending all your time leading an institution, then you feel you get de-skilled. So certainly very hard work, but God's blessed us in amazing ways, and we've seen remarkable financial provision at times. Just lots of individual stories where God's doing things that are just so encouraging. So right now, very encouraged.
So moving towards now, the presentations of yesterday and today, give us a sense as to your interest in the parables in general and kind of how that's developed and where the book came from.
Yeah, so I remember it must have been like maybe 16 years ago in Houston, first doing Luke 15 as an interactive Bible study. And I found it worked really well, that you could just ask people, what's going on here? A man had two sons, that remind you of anything? And people used to say Abraham, and I say, no, that's wrong. It's Isaac. And but gradually over time, I realized, no, it's right. It is. But I learned a lot from interacting with people on that. And it, because I'm an itinerant speaker, I obviously reuse a lot of material, and you get to reusing things. But what I found is this is, I can say, a party piece that you can use in almost any setting. You can do a 5-minute version, you can do a 50-minute version. I was up there with no notes because it's one of those things that I'm fairly comfortable speaking about in almost any way, more or less interaction, big crowd, small crowd. And so that's been, in a sense, where I've enjoyed that, but also just seeing more and more as you bounce off other of God's people, what's there. Obviously, reading lots of books on it, some of which are more helpful than others.
So you were intentional yesterday and today on the front end about two points that when you hear Luke 15 preached, one is often misstated, the other is often overlooked. You were very clear to make clear one parable, three stories. You often hear Luke 15 preached as three parables.
Yeah.
The other point, so that's often misstated. The other point that's often overlooked is you took great pains to say, look, you have two different audiences. You have sinners and tax collectors, don't know the Bible. You have whatever, scribes and Pharisees who do know the Bible.
Yeah.
Elaborate on both of those, just the importance of getting those two foundational elements
right. Yeah, and so one of the things I should have said in the talks, but
if you had notes,
omitted saying, if I've noticed that, thank you very much, is actually, it's an amazing evidence that it was given to exactly the audience Luke says, because if it weren't given to people who are Bible experts, why would there be references that Bible experts spot, you know? Maybe I should use notes, but they take up space. No. So what I found is, given the question again.
Just the importance of one parable, not three, and of the two audiences.
Yeah. What I really want to people to go away with is not think that they need to dwell on these Old Testament references that I talk about, because I think there's a danger that someone could go away and feel that they've been preaching the story wrong. And I don't think that's right. I think there are loads and loads of fabulous sermons that you can do on this. And that's part of the beauty of Jesus giving us this masterpiece, raw material. So, you know, if someone says it's three parables, not one, I don't think they're doing something super wrong. It is three stories, and they each, in a sense, are their own riddle as well. But there is nevertheless this unity where I think the sort of Sudoku type way I tried to say, you know, lost away from home, lost at home, son goes away, son at home. That seems to make an awful lot of sense there. But they've each got their own little twists. Like one thing I didn't dwell on is the psychology of the difference between men and women. You know, why is it that the man says the sheep that was lost and the woman says the sheep, the coin that I lost? I mean, you know, I walk around Cambridge and I might bump into some various people. It's the women who apologize. And it's just one of those.
Just like, a problem at Cambridge.
Yeah. Yeah. But it's just one of those just ever so subtle things that's going on in the story. So they're not all the same story, if that makes sense. I just think there are so many different ways you can look at them. So I don't want to say other ways of doing it are wrong. I actually would be a little bit more pluralist about it.
And the two audiences?
Yeah, I mean, there are four groups, there are two groups. I think it's a model to us in terms of how we preach, teach, as in the ability to teach simply and with depth. So I do try and think about that in terms of pedagogy. I think this fascinating thing where Jesus says to the Pharisees, you take away the keys of knowledge. The Bible experts or scholars generally can lock up knowledge behind complicated phraseology. And what we see is Jesus, the wisest person, the greatest intellect ever to walk the planet, speaking with amazing simplicity. So for me, there's a model about how to teach. And what I've realized is when I've taught in more complex ways, it's often because I don't understand the topic properly. When you really grasp a topic, you can simplify. That's why Jesus can, you know, come out with such amazing things like, you know, those who live by the sword will die by the sword. He understands everything about the universe, and so he can make these amazing statements. The truth will set you free, and you just realize this is mind-blowing stuff. So I would say with the two audiences, big challenge for us to try and reach different groups and maybe have depth in our teaching at the same time as simplicity. And I do think there's a challenge to the Pharisees and scribes, who in a sense get less of the parable directed at them. They shouldn't need as much. They should be able, you know, Jesus doesn't bend over backwards for them in the same way. And that seems to me significant.
So I know you have research interests beyond the New Testament, but within the context of the New Testament, is there a particular genre of literature or a particular book of the New Testament, particular author that you have been most drawn to? And I don't mean just from like text criticism, you know, your technical work, but just even exegetically, homiletically.
I am more drawn to the Gospels than the Epistles. The Epistles are incredible, but I do like narrative. And also when it's the Old Testament, I also like the narrative and the history. That's just what I find easier. And I struggle more with the prophecy. And when I'm preaching, I will tend to be doing narrative more.
And give us a sense as far as the local church dynamic in the Cambridge area.
Yeah.
So, and then we'd love your comment more broadly on the spiritual state of the UK.
Yeah, so I think the numbers of Christians are relatively low, and politically we were on our lowest number ever I can remember of sort of high profile Christians, and those involved in government. At the same time, there are green shoots, not just the sort of slight turn towards Christianity we might be seeing at the global intellectual level that's going on, but also just in terms of church planting and growth numbers. And where I am, Eden Baptist Church, we are struggling to fit people in every Sunday morning, and even encouraging people to look elsewhere, looking at church planting, number of churches being planted. Lots of places in Britain, you know, it's hard to find a place to rent for a church because everywhere is being rented. That was the case in Aberdeen when I lived there. It's the case in Cambridge. It's hard to find a room because there are so many churches. So I'd say the countryside, a lot of places struggling, but the cities, I would say there's more going on. And we have, of course, we've got quite a bit of immigration from Nigeria, which has this massively growing population and large numbers of Christians, which is another sort of new dynamic going on. So we have mega churches now in the UK, which, you know, just a few, but not many, you know, but that does happen.
Give us a sense, as far as your personal research interests, any projects before you in the immediate future or more distant?
What I'm hoping, Lord willing, for 2028 is to have a book on the reliability of the Old Testament. So can we trust the Old Testament? And I'm looking at 350 pages, so something substantial, but still short enough to be readable. So somewhat like my book, Can We Trust the Gospels, where I tried to be very simple there, but still have depth. I want it to be like that. I think people have often got confused by looking to prove history department level confidence in something, rather than ask the more Alvin Plantinga type approach of, is it rational to trust something? And I want to do that with what we've got historically in relation to the Old Testament. And I think it is astoundingly good case that we can make about how rational it would be to trust that the Old Testament really happened. So you can't prove to a history department that God had a particular conversation with Adam or Abraham or anything like that, but you could show that it is entirely rational to trust that this really took place. And so that's the sort of book I'm going to be excited to write, and also to try and make sure we have no eccentricity in there. So I'm an early Exodus guy, but it's going to be written in such a way that it's not going to be partisan on that. It's going to be looking at broad patterns so that it's as useful as it can be for everyone. So that's what I'm trying to do, and I think it can be done.
As far as the work at Tyndale House, the ministry taking place there, what do you find most encouraging these days?
I think, you know, it's who God brings your way. I mean, it was nice to meet, you know, an 18-year-old PhD student the other day with three master's degrees, you know, and God raising up one person there, but you just see different people in different countries, and, you know, some of them different struggles.
Is his name Doogie Howser?
No, we've got some Egyptians.
That's a dated reference.
Some Egyptians. Good to see what God's doing there. I mean, the need is vast, isn't it? When you think about how we've got a world where the church is growing, there's a global shortage of pastors, there's a massive shortage of trained pastors, and there's a massive shortage of people to train the pastor, train the people to train the pastors. And so I think there's loads of opportunities.
Peter, thank you so much.
Well, thank you for having me here.
Being with us, and we wish you Godspeed as you fly back here in a few hours. Thank you so much. Thank you for being with us today and for listening to Preaching and Preachers. For more information, go to my website, jasonkallen.com. That's jasonkallen.com.